Well, thank you all for coming. We'll go ahead and get started so that we stay on time. I also would like to welcome any virtual participants, anybody online who is here. The people online didn't, I guess they got here the earliest, perhaps, and so they got the seats furthest in the back. The earlier you get here, the more seats in the back that are available. So I'm glad to see some people sort of filled in the front. I promise I won't be a jerk and make people move up. So if anybody has any questions online or in the room, if we don't get any questions, we're going to feel sad. Please don't make us feel sad. We want to be happy. I'm going to introduce myself. My name is Tom Cavanaugh. I am the Assistant Vice President of Distributed Learning at the University of Central Florida in Orlando. I am joined by my colleagues, Drs. Chuck Jubin and Patsy Moskal, who are the Director and Associate Director of the Research Initiative for Teaching Effectiveness, which is part of our Center for Distributed Learning. And we're going to talk today a little bit about our Next Generation Learning Challenge grant, a little bit about what it is to give you some context, but mostly about how we are assessing it, because the assessment strategy has been interesting, challenging, and hopefully at some point satisfying. We're in the midst of it right now. So with no further ado, what is our Next Generation Learning Challenge grant? We at UCF partnered with the American Association of State Colleges and Universities. And the goal is to take what UCF has done in blended learning and scale it across the ASCU network of institutions across the country. So UCF has been doing distance learning for a long time and blended learning for almost all of that time. About 17 years we've been doing blended learning. We have a lot of data about its effectiveness, and we think we've got a pretty good model that's been validated as being successful and efficient. I won't go into the details now about why I make that claim, but if you would like details, please feel free to read a very short article. It's got lots of pictures. It's in EDUCAUSE Quarterly, in the current issue, so please go check it out. I wrote a little thing there, and there's lots of details about our model and about this project in general with a lot of links and follow-ups and stuff. And as an aside, I'm happy to answer any questions afterwards or send an email, and I'll be happy to talk to you more about what we're doing. So ASCU is an association of state colleges and universities. There are 420 members across their entire network. They span the entire country. They have everything from 1,000 student schools up to really large schools with 58,600 students, which happens to be UCF. So it really runs the gamut. But there's a lot of similarities across, and most of them all have an access mission. They are concerned about serving certain populations. And that really dovetails well with the Next Generation Learning Challenge audience. They're really targeting students who are under 26 and who are low income. Really, those who are most at risk of dropping out or stopping out is the target population. And that is consistent with the Gates Foundation's goals and their education program. And the Gates Foundation is the one that put up most of the money behind NGLC, as you may be aware. So that's the goal. Take UCF's model and try and replicate it across the ASCU network. We're starting with 20 schools, and they're in these states. The Florida is a different color because it's just us, and we're coordinating it. But we chose 20 schools based upon their willingness to make an institutional commitment to participate in a very short amount of time on an aggressive schedule, and did their populations match up with the target population that NGLC was looking for. So we got institutional buy-in from the provost level, and Patsy will talk a little bit about working with the direct faculty and assessment coordinators on each campus to try and capture what's actually happening now that we've started implementing the project. These are the partners. We're working with two different categories of partners. One is individual institutions, so those are on the left there. So we're working with them on a kind of a one-to-one basis mediated by the ASCU Central Network. And then we've got three state consortia that we're working with, and each consortium is coordinated by a coordinating institution. Missouri is the largest, but we've also got Minnesota and Alabama as state consortium. Each institution received a stipend from our NGLC grant funding in order to help incent the implementation of blended learning on their campuses. And in most cases, they use that money for stipends for faculty to redevelop their courses. We didn't dictate to them how they would spend that stipend money, but there were some broad parameters about a commitment that they would have to deliver so many sections over a certain amount of time, and that they would use that money wisely and have to report out at the very end. Each of the schools on the left got $10,000. Each consortium on the right got $20,000. And the truth is, that's really not that much money to do a major project. So I give all these institutions credit. They're really trying to make every dollar count. The grants, as you may know, is a $250,000 grant. UCF got a little bit to do what I'll talk to you about in a moment. ASCU took $0 to coordinate on their end, and each school got that amount of money. So we like to say this is the Lord's work, because we're all donating all our time to really work on it. But we really think it's an important project, and the results we hope are important. $250,000 just really doesn't go as far as it used to go. So what are we doing? So how do you coordinate across a network of 20 institutions that are literally all across the country? What we tried to do is centralize a repository of resources and best practices that really encapsulate what I said about UCF's model. We think UCF's model is successful. We've got data to prove that. And so we try to capture that in what we're calling the blended learning toolkit. And the toolkit contains what you see. It's a collection of best practices and strategies, example courses, models, course design principles. We've got faculty that we've captured, we've archived talking about their blended course implementations. We've got two model courses that you can just download and use as is, or you can customize for your own institutional contexts. We've got directions for how to apply the toolkit for courses other than the two example courses that we provide. We ran three different faculty development programs over last summer, kind of the train-the-trainer programs. I'll talk more in detail about those in a moment. And then Patsy will go into detail about the assessment and data collection protocols. We also connected with the ASCU network of meetings. I was literally in San Antonio on Friday and Saturday participating in one of their academic affairs meetings, which was an opportunity to get in front of some more of our partners that were there and kind of spread the word and recruit more people to potentially join the network. There's the ASCU Red Balloon Project, if you're familiar with that. Many of these schools are also Red Balloon schools. If you're not familiar with it, look it up. It's a really cool project. So what did we promise to do? We said we would deliver 217 blended course sections over the course of this project that would not have otherwise existed as blended course sections. And knowing that there would probably be some attrition or change, we committed to 85% of that, which is technically 184.5 courses. Rounding up, 185. If we don't quite hit that number, I will round down to 184. We also are targeting those same low-income students under 26. And across that network of schools, the population of those students is over 187,000 students. We're qualifying that by Pell Grant status. So that's how we know if we're talking about low income. The first thing that I tried to do was just get out of the way. Even though I was the PI and kind of coordinating things, the best thing to do was to connect the disciplinary folks with each other as quickly as possible. So we have a coordinator at UCF for composition. She's become sort of a national figure in the writing about writing movement. And she coordinated with all of the composition faculty across all of the institutions. The model that she and her colleague Debbie Weaver at UCF built, a blended composition course, is what we're calling the prefix menu or the a la carte menu. So the prefix menu is you could just take the whole course as is and use it to teach composition on your campus in a blended format. You can upload it as an IMS package into your LMS, or you could take a Microsoft Word version and copy and paste and change whatever you want to change. The idea is to make it not prescriptive, but give you the tools to not have to reinvent the wheel if you wanted to implement this. Debbie and Elizabeth and actually a couple of their colleagues also facilitated cohorts over the summer on how to teach composition in this writing about writing construct in a blended environment. Tammy News is a National Center for Academic Transformation scholar at UCF, has done a lot of work in academic transformation using blended learning and an Emporium model at UCF to redesign the algebra curriculum, and she's had great success and has been flown around the country to speak about it. And she did the same kind of a thing, developed this flexible template on how to implement a blended learning model for algebra and other math. And she also facilitated faculty development over the summer. Okay, everybody take out your pen, write down this URL. Take out your pen, write down this URL. I hope you do, and I hope you go check it out. It's called blendedlearningtoolkit.org. This is where all of that stuff lives that I just described. It is all available right now for free. For free. Under a Creative Commons share-alike attribution license. All that stuff is out there, including the model courses. You can use them right now if you want. I'll show you a little picture of what it looks like. Isn't it lovely? Feel free to go explore it. I don't have time to go through it right now, but that's another presentation someday. You have a question?
Quick question. How many hours are you checking the faculty with a Creative Commons course? How many hours do you tell them that they need to participate?
How many hours would they be participating? I have to repeat the question. How many hours would they be participating to partake in the faculty development course? It varied according to... because we had three different faculty development courses, and each of them kind of were a different thing. And I'll talk about one of them in a second, which was sort of up to the participant. The composition program, I'll be honest, I don't remember. But it was significant enough that they did have to do some work. And in fact, that's my department, and I signed up to just go through it, and it turned out I just didn't have time to do it. So it was enough of a burden that it wasn't just phoning it in or reading stuff. There was real activities. You actually built a course as you went through, and it was meaningful. So if you wanted to follow up with me after, I could find out the hours for you and let you know. So please go to the toolkit and check it out and use it, please. We spent a lot of time building it. This is one of the faculty development courses that I just mentioned. This is for all disciplines, including algebra and algebra and composition. Although it was really designed to help faculty teaching in other things, to understand how to design and deliver blended learning. It was taught by Kelvin Thompson in our office, and Kelvin's become kind of famous as a result of this. I keep getting requests for Kelvin to facilitate this again for other institutions, and I have to unfortunately say no. We've got other things Kelvin is supposed to do for UCF. But as you'll see in a moment, the materials are all out there. The entire curriculum is out there. All the readings, all the checklists, there's peer assessment, there's self-assessment, there's webinars that we've archived. It's a whole 5-week curriculum that exists that you're welcome to use. And you could deliver on your own, in your own professional development. And in fact, many of our partners have started to do that. So it was taught as a MOOC, sort of a quasi-MOOC, we like to say. So I think most people are familiar with a MOOC, a massively open online course. We had about 200 participants. Interestingly enough, more than half of them were not even part of the grant. There were people that just... I did a webinar for the NGLC Summer Series during the summer, and I think some people kind of found out about it at that point and signed up, and then... I spoke about it at other conferences and just tried to evangelize the use of the Blended Learning Toolkit. And people signed up, literally from all over the world, to use this faculty development program. And we found it enormously gratifying at UCF. These are the kinds of things that are in there that I just mentioned. You can write down that link if you want, but you can also access it from within the toolkit. That's just a shortcut. You would go to professional development in the toolkit. This is a screen capture of the schedule, which is sort of the organizing schema of the entire course. It's got all the materials, all the readings, all the archived webinars, the interviews with faculty. And although it's a little bit UCF-centric because we were doing this really quickly over the summer, we did grab faculty from other institutions to talk about their implementations of blended learning. So we've got somebody from University of Illinois Chicago. I think we've got somebody from Simmons College. There's a couple of other places that we talked to. And so this is all available to you if you wanted to run your own, here's how to teach blended learning on your own campus professional development program. So with all of that, I am just perfect on time. It never happens. So part of what we had to do was evaluate what we're doing. The Gates Foundation and NGLC had some very specific sorts of requirements. And My colleague Patsy Moskal is going to talk a little bit more about the kind of data that we gathered as well as some of the challenges we faced.
Thank you. Thank you, Tom. I should say that this previous slide, the folks who went through this was a la carte. So if you felt like you were only interested in week four, you could come in and do week four. And so that was a very interesting experience also. When it came time, I think you've already gotten an idea of the scope and scale of what we're talking about here. And actually, it's an evolving scope and scale as we've gone through the grant. But when it came time for us to try to design an evaluation on how are we going to get some data on this, we fell back on, of course, what we know and what we have used for years on our campus. And that is part of our distributed learning impact evaluation, which Tom alluded to. We've been evaluating online and blended learning courses on our campus for 17 years now. And so we looked at our design, which focused on the students and the faculty, and said, what components can we take out of this that might actually be useful and that we can get data on when we're scaling? Keeping in mind, of course, that it gets a little bit more complicated when you go from individual class-based research to what is now beyond our institution. So with each step up the level, it becomes increasingly more complicated with a lot more issues involved, which I'll kind of allude to as I go through this today. Tom mentioned the 20 institutions. This gives you an idea of where they are. These are the ASCU partner institutions that we had direct contact with and a lot of direct contact with. That blend kit, this is an indication of where folks were who registered for the blend kit. And in fact, this is only the United States. We had people not in the United States and quite a few people from Canada, but it doesn't fit on a pretty slide, so I only showed you United States here. The blend kit is a separate component to the evaluation, I'll tell you. Kelvin Thompson and I are looking at what can we get, who registered, and try to get some feedback from them on what did you find useful, what didn't work, what did you use on your campus. So that's something separate, and I'm not really talking about that today, but if you're interested, either Kelvin or I would be happy to follow up with you on that also. So we have our 20 different campuses, and as Tom said, our ASCU partners were very... they were critical to contacting the provost of these campuses, making sure we had buy-in, and getting everyone on board to be part of our grant. You can imagine how critical that is in terms of success. We had a designated assessment contact at each partner school. We went through a group spaces site so I could email blast out the people that I needed to contact when I was interacting with them. I also did a lot of one-on-one contact with them. And my job involved helping them with IRB. Keep in mind that in some cases that assessment contact was the institutional research director at their institutions, and in some cases that would be an individual faculty member who may not ever have done research or IRB. So there was a ride. Remember that scale, I'm telling you. Keep going back to that in terms of the complexity of the actual project. So in terms of helping them through IRB, we did not do IRB. It's not possible. They have to do that on their own individual campuses. So they had to fulfill whatever requirement they have with regard to IRB on their campuses. But we did help them through the process and answer any questions they had with regard to the data. We house the data. So we used, in terms of assessment data collection, they have to provide us with the student data, including demographics and grades, at the end of the course. And we use that to look at, obviously, success, which we define as A, B, or C, and also the retention, withdrawal issues in terms of both the students overall and also the low-income students, which was the focus of the NGLC grant. And low-income was defined as Pell status on each of these because, again, you had to have what's a common thread across 20 different institutions. We developed centralized online forms for surveying both the students and the faculty, which, in an effort to try to make it easy, I provided them with the cover letters, the consent form, everything that they needed just to be able to advertise. So all they had to do was advertise it to their faculty or to their students. And then the data, we collect and we actually interact with the data and dealing with it. For those of you who are visual, and like to see it in a picture form, we got a picture for you. We like pictures. So the four components, we're looking at the organization, the training, the learning, and the teaching environments. And you know, our motto is uncollected data cannot be analyzed. If there was a way to try to get it, we got it. And we're still in the process, as you can imagine, of sifting through reams of data here. The first outcome in terms of the organization is the scale, which Tom mentioned. In fall 2011, we had 96 course sections, 2,600 students, plus students, 12 different schools. Not everyone could actually get their courses up and running in the fall. So we have a number of schools who taught both fall and spring. Some taught one or the other. In many cases, they would come on board planning to teach college algebra, and they decided they wanted a biology course that was blended and asked, could we also add some other sections, for instance. Things changed as the semester began, and course enrollments didn't make. If a particular course didn't make, then they asked, could we substitute different courses that were actually blended? You get an idea of the complexity, right? We had 55 teachers, and 46% of the students ended up being low income in the fall. The spring data, we only have preliminary data for now, because what the plan is to have 62 course sections, as our campuses have told us, and approximately 1,400 students, again, 12 of the schools, and it looks like 36 teachers. I would expect that to evolve as we go through it. Different campuses have different calendars in terms of when they begin and how what their length of courses are and so forth. Some preliminary findings. So we have looked at, we have the student data and the student satisfaction data and the faculty data. Looking at the student experience, we actually surveyed them in the fall near the end of the semester. And hallelujah, as Tom said, we're doing the Lord's work. We got 521 responses. Keep in mind that I am removed from the person. I'm used to submitting a student survey to my students. I went through the assessment coordinator, who may or may not be the faculty, who then, if it's not the faculty member, had to contact the faculty member, who then had to contact the student. So I learned quickly, being a control freak, that sometimes you just got to let it go and hope for the best and see what happens. So when we got, you know, when you send out a survey, the first thing you think is, what happens if nobody responds? And so I was really ecstatic to see that over 500 students responded on the 20 different campuses. 84% of them were freshmen, which was no surprise. 49% were white Caucasian. 86% had never taken a blended course before, which of course was the goal of the grant, to try to expand blended learning on these campuses. Interestingly, 66% had never even taken a course with a web component. So the use of online varied widely on the 20 different campuses. We asked them, I'm going to go through really briefly. I have a lot more data, but of course I don't have time to show you a lot more data. How satisfied were you? 59% liked their blended course, said they were satisfied. We of course asked them for more detail on that. What'd you like most? No surprise, right? What's the number one reason they choose online and blended? Convenience. This is the top five reasons, by the way. We took this is, as you can imagine, 500 different written comments, which were in varying degrees. So we sifted through and looked at what kinds of themes did we get out of that. And these are the things they said they liked the most about it. Obviously, the ease of access. They felt like it was easy to get help through the web, and the learning, both online and face-to-face. What'd you like least? Again, not really a surprise that technology, when it fails or there's issues with the technology, that's a problem for our students. They also felt like there's less face-to-face teaching time, which is interesting. They like it. We find the same thing on our campus. Our students love not coming to class, but then they complain that they don't have more face-to-face time. They also felt they're removed from when they had issues and they're at home on their computer. They feel like there's like I need help like now. And so that creates a little bit of dissonance with them. They felt very like they were time-consuming. They did a lot of work. Our students find that they come into online and blended courses perhaps thinking they're going to be easier in some way, and they're not. Yeah, Walker? We distributed to everyone, yes. Yeah, it was like a massive blast to everyone. And then some of them, of course, realized their time management issues were something that created a problem for them. So we asked him, all right, if you're giving advice to somebody else who's going to take an online course, what would you say, or blended course? Stay on task. I would argue that's probably important for face-to-face classes as well. But it's especially important when you're an online and you have an online component where you have to be kind of motivated to go in there and make sure you stay on topic and on time. Don't be afraid to use tutoring and review on your own time, which is really important. Attend the face-to-face class sections and make sure you have good time management skills. Very good advice. If they would listen to themselves, they would be very successful students, right? So in terms of student success, I have no data to show you because with 20 different campuses, 2 days before I got here, I received the last scrap of data from those people. So it was very, we've got a lot of data to sift through, but what we're doing is defining student success as A, B, or C. We got grades. We also got demographics from each of the campuses. And one of the requirements for IRB is we aggregate everything into one file so that we can maintain the anonymity of the data. I was very critical. I'm answering IRB questions even as they're trying to get the data because their institutional research offices were giving them trouble with, well, you can identify a low-income student in a specific class. And so the assurance that we aren't going to be able to do that because everyone's going to be in one pot and we're looking at the data aggregated across all 20 campuses, that was a very important component. It has been a very important component. Because of the demographics that we're looking at, we can actually look at success and withdrawal by low income, by the different discipline of the course, and by gender and ethnicity. So that's our to be done in the near future. In terms of faculty, we also looked at what was their experience here. So we sent a survey to the faculty and got 28 responses. Remember, there were, I think, 55 faculty who taught in the fall. So that's not bad for respondents. 54% were math, 32% were English, and 14% other. Some of them, I think, were actually teaching more than one course. And 75% were white Caucasian. Almost half had taught a blended course before. And 45% had actually used web components in a past course. So we asked them, if you had a choice, would you do this again? As you can tell, there was 69% that said, yeah, probably I would, probably or definitely I would teach a blended course again. Not sure they'd do it in this fast, compressed time. What are the positive aspects? Again, these are the top five. They like it's best of both worlds. They got to use some web components. They got to also continue to have face-to-face contact time with their students. They liked that it was individualized. They could do more individualized instruction with the students, and they felt like they had more interaction with their students. So in some sense, they said I made better use of my face-to-face time because of what I could do with online. And they felt like, they did like the reduced face-to-face as well. Negative aspects, always negative. Again, interesting, they like not coming to class, but they don't like not having face-to-face. So faculty were the same way. They liked they said the negative aspects were the online assignments, and I think part of that was realizing the students, trying to make sure the students kept up and encouraging them. Keep in mind that for many, this is the very first time they had taught a blended course, and definitely the first time they taught this specific course blended. So if any of you have taught, you understand the first time you teach a course is probably not the best time you teach that course. So one of the things that would be nice is to follow these people as they go through the next few semesters. Lack of preparation, they felt like they were kind of hurried at getting their course up and were tweaking as they were going along. Undisciplined students is a problem no matter what modality you're teaching, right? And then again, the technology problems, any kind of problems with technology creates a big issue for the students or for the faculty. We also asked them, did you find that teaching the blended and learning about blended learning changed your face-to-face teaching? And here's what they said. They actually were starting to enrich their face-to-face courses with some technology as a result of the experience. They felt like they planned better, and they were able to differentiate between what's good on the different modalities in terms of their components of their classes. And they actually felt like they could put some materials on the web that helped them slow down and focus on what they did in a face-to-face environment. All good stuff. The issues, I think we've alluded to that a little bit. You've kind of picked up on the issues we have. You know, we are at the mercy of the kindness of strangers for responses. I should tell you, that's the first half of the evaluation. Keep in mind that I've only talked to people from the fall, and I will have to regroup, redo the entire thing. I'm starting that again for the spring semesters. So this is like the grant that will never die. You know, we'll just keep going on here. There are also different contexts. We've all had our provost tell us, you know, I have an opportunity for you. That plays out better depending on where you are and what your background is, what you have on your plate already. Many of the faculty, we had a number of meetings that coincided with the Ask You provost meetings, and we asked that they bring some of the faculty to them. We met at the beginning of the grant in Portland, and which was invaluable because I was able to make face-to-face contact with a lot of the assessment coordinators and also some of the faculty, which has come in very handy when I've had to interact with them regarding, you know, can you get me this data and here's the survey and that kind of stuff. I think that was an invaluable part, actually being able to see the person you're talking to and not just think, you know, who the heck is this Patsy person who keeps sending me another email asking me for stuff. Local buy-in, again, you know, I'm sure some of these people are more ecstatic about doing this than others. Many of the faculty I met in Portland were really excited about the opportunity to be able to do blended. And others that weren't there, I don't know. I don't know how excited they were. Unfortunately, as I said, I think the true value in this would be seeing the staying power, seeing how this plays out beyond the grant on these campuses. So it would be nice to be able to follow up with them and see, did it really change not only the individual faculty member, but also the culture of the institution and in terms of blended and how they use blended? And does it continue, you know, did you find your success rates got higher as you taught multiple sections and multiple semesters and so forth? No budget for that. One-time deals. We all know grant work, right? So there's no budget for individual site visits, which actually is kind of disappointing. Learning outcomes, all we have is grades. And as we know, I can't equate a grade in a class necessarily to how much you learned. And so that would be nice to also be able to assess the actual learning that's occurring in the individual courses. I will tell you that some of the campuses, when I met with them in Portland, they were planning their own comparison of face-to-face and blended. So the more savvy, those campuses that had institutional research folks who were on board from day one had already planned on, we're going to actually look at data on how this works on our campus. So that was really interesting, and I'm hoping to follow up with those individual people as well. And obviously, you know, there's never enough time, there's never enough money in a grant, and this is no different. So the biggest thing that, you know, I'd say we learned is that large-scale evaluation is very much like herding cats. If you guys remember the past Super Bowl, I don't know if you remember, that was years ago, the past Super Bowl ad of what it's like herding cats. And I have jokingly and affectionately said, I just hope I don't run into any feral, rabid ones as I go through this process. So that gives you an idea. Real quickly, do you have any questions? Yeah, John. John's question is, can we correlate the student grade data with the actual survey satisfaction? No. The short answer is no. It's all anonymous. The survey itself came in, everybody got the link to the survey, and it's anonymous. There's no way, I mean, and even to do that, I would have violated IRB. I mean, that would have been a nightmare across 20 campuses trying to get that through IRB and ask the students for identifiers on the survey, which was at a different time. The students aren't even interacting with the grade data that's coming from the institutional research and so forth. So the best I can do is kind of make comparisons like different camp. I can look at the campuses and see how it's going, which is a loose measure at best.
Being an NGLC, how to scale these models for student success, particularly
That's a very good question. NGLC has an external SRI is their evaluator, and they have their own spreadsheet in terms of how they are doing this across the 29 different blended learning grants, I know. And so they are collecting the enrollment, the completion rates as for everyone as well as the low-income students. And that is, again, it's not perfect. It's not good. And what we learned is our particular project is way beyond, I mean, 20 campuses is way beyond the scope and scale of the other projects, which were, you know, it's a little bit different when you're on your own campus. If you're able to work with your regional campuses, that's a little step removed that's more complicated, but 20 different campuses was kind of out of the ballpark, I think. So there's one more question. The question is, are there any recommendations for course sizes at this model? I will tell you it varies widely, and across the 20 institutions it varies widely. My best recommendation is it depends. I think it depends on the faculty member, it depends on the discipline, and it depends on the culture of the institution. At our institution, we have very large classes, but we've been doing it for 17 years. So there aren't as many of the issues with the technology, with the support. We've got a lot of support for our students, and we've built up to the class sizes that we have. I think it's a little bit different when you're beginning. So Chuck's getting antsy. Chuck's got to speak now. So he's moving. I got the body language. So I'll be happy if you have it. Oh, one more real quick. The question is, are we actually correlating satisfaction with the grades at our own institution? We actually do. We do the sidebar, and that's I'm going to give you the two-second version. The sidebar is in addition to the overall evaluation of online and blended on our institution. We also work with faculty on scholarship of teaching and learning. So we do a lot with programs, with faculty programs, colleges, and so forth, to get at those kinds of questions. Yeah. Chuck? My colleague Chuck Jubin is going to follow up with words of wisdom, I'm sure.
Are we okay with the mic? Yeah. No.
I hate technology. Yes? Yeah, all right. Thanks for the feedback. Okay, I'll go here. I'm going to give you some observations on what my colleagues are doing. I will tell you that you're certainly welcome to talk to Patsy Moskal or Kelvin Thompson. You cannot offer them a job under any circumstances, but you can talk to them all you want. If I were giving my colleagues advice on the evaluation of this particular project, you remember Dead Poets Society? Yeah, what I would advise them to do to take their research methods books and tear out all the experimental design sections, because they don't apply. They simply do not apply in this particular situation when you're trying to scale it. Sun Tzu says in The Art of War that one of the most important things in The Art of War is terrain. And he gives six terrains in that book and how important they are to understanding. However, these people are dealing with a minimum of 20 terrains. Each one is different. Each one is unique. Each one has its own issues. Each one has its own strengths, and each one has its own weaknesses. So what they're trying to do here is to coordinate across these at multiple levels at multiple times. Now, you saw Patsy's diagram about scaling and opportunity costs. Put anything else you want in there in the vertical section. Put complexity, put pain in the butt. I mean, put anything that you want there in terms of that, because it gets complicated and it gets very much extended when you begin to do this kind of stuff. Okay, now, Jared Diamond, in his stunning book, Germs, Guns, and Steel, talks about how ideas go through cultures. And he talks about two ways. That is blueprint transmission, or a blueprint adoption, excuse me, or idea transmission. That is, a culture sees a blueprint and they adopt it completely. Or They see the idea and they say, this is a good idea, but I'm not going to do it the way they are doing it. I'm going to develop my own way of doing it. That's what these schools are doing. Now, one of the issues these people face is something called a boundary object. Do you know that blended learning is a boundary object? Susan Lee Starr, in a wonderful piece, defined the notion of a boundary object. It is something that brings a community together, you know, and they all say they believe in it. But when they go off into their individual constituencies, they all define it differently. We are operating with many, many boundary objects in education. Give me an I'll give you an example. Critical thinking. Everyone says, oh yeah, I love critical thinking. But when you get a whole group of faculty together to talk about critical thinking, what happens? They all define it differently. Physicists, philosophers, English, math, it's all different. It's all absolutely different. So that's what's happening in this grant. And that's what they're wrestling with in trying to scale up this particular grant. Now, Jared Diamond also talked about something in terms of how things develop. And what he did is, he talked about some ideas which are autocatalytic. The whole notion of what they do is, and what this group is trying to do, is to get a network together where groups of people will build synergy, build on each other, and continue the initiative long after we have pulled out of it. We're hoping it looks something like this. Here we are now, UCF in the middle, with ASCU, okay, talking to all of our schools. Now, they are talking to us, you know, in many ways. What we want them to do is begin talking to each other. Then we want them to begin talking to each other more. And then we want them to go talking to the rest of the world. We want them to be doing this. This is the objective of this scaling. Now, what do you lose when you scale this way? You lose control. It's as simple as that, you lose control. What these people are trying to create are mavens. Do you know what mavens are? Stephen, you know, Malcolm Gladwell's book, Blink, it's wonderful. Mavens, maven is a Yiddish word for one who understands. What they're trying to create on each of these campuses is experts who then will share their knowledge with the rest of the campus. That's exactly what they're trying to do. They're trying to build this kind of a thing. This is what this grant is about. This is what this grant is trying to build in terms of the scaling notion. Now, give you another metaphor for what they're trying to do. They're trying to build a coffee house. 1853 in England, everyone drank alcohol. The water wasn't any good. So what they would do is have a couple of beers in the morning, have a little wine with lunch, you know, have a few beers in the afternoon, have a little more wine with dinner, drink a little in the evening. So basically they spent their whole time drunk. Okay? So what happened was ideas were very, very difficult to come by. They certainly didn't share ideas. And then in London, there was the first coffee house. So they switched from a depressant to a stimulant. And then the ideas began popping all over the place. These people began coming into the coffee house. They began talking to each other, and all kinds of ideas developed. It was kind of a renaissance. As Stephen Johnson says, it was a place where ideas could have sex. Literally, in terms of people talking to each other and developing ideas. That's the objective of this MGLC grant. It is very, very difficult to control, but what you can do is try to build this autocatalytic network that responds in an interactive kind of way that builds as it works. I know there are some people in the audience. Is Jen here, Jen Riley? Yeah, Jen Riley back at University of Massachusetts Durham is doing exactly the same thing on her campus. Right, Jen? Trying to build an autocatalytic network on her campus for blended learning where faculty begin to feed off each other and then, you know, infiltrate throughout departments. And it's working very well. It's working very well. Now, her next task will be do it for the entire state of Massachusetts, okay, then the country, then the world, and then the galaxy. Okay? Now, there will be lots of bumps along the road. Okay? If I were to classify these, and I'm a big classifier, into three groups. You know, three is an iconic number. Okay? You know, three sheets to the wind, three coins in a fountain, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, three strikes you're out. Three is an iconic number. These people will come in groups of three. Three people who will buy, yeah, a group of people who will buy on, some who may not buy on, and some who can be convinced. You know, that's what happens in projects like this. So that's what's going on from my perception. Now, we will entertain questions. We hope you have some because we have 15 minutes. Yes?
I can maybe start on that. So the question was, once faculty start teaching blended learning, how do you get them to kind of buy in and do it well? Is that a good summary of the question? I've heard a story of a faculty member at UCF who said that it wasn't until they envisioned their course less as, I'm going to blend my face-to-face course, add online components to my face-to-face course, and just changed the paradigm of how they envision their course to, I'm going to add some face-to-face elements to an online course, that they kind of got it at that point. It was no longer taking, all right, I'm going to do what I do face-to-face, I'm going to add some web components. Because then you're not really leveraging the affordances of each modality in that way. To totally re-envision your course as a new thing, as blended learning as a new thing, I think is what's necessary. And for this particular faculty member, it helped him to think of blended learning as an online class with face-to-face components.
One of the things that we do on our campus also in providing faculty development is we focus on that issue. So in terms of not just taking your face-to-face and dividing it into the two sides, but actually rethinking the whole course structure itself. But it does require, you know, a change in your brain. I mean, change is hard. We gravitate towards what we're comfortable with. So, I mean, that is always the challenge, I think.
I like to always say, let the content dictate the treatment. So don't just arbitrarily say, oh, I got to put all my discussions in the classroom because that seems to be the most. Maybe not. You know, it really depends on what your course is trying to accomplish.
Oh, that's hard, yeah. Use up your jokes. Yeah.
Yeah. And when you only have one joke, it's kind of hard not to keep repeating
right.
it, right?
So. When you have limited material, it's really tough.
Let me offer one thing real quick, Chuck. And at the risk of temporary insanity, I will say this out loud. We will probably request from NGLC continuation funding. And if we don't get that, we will probably request, there's a provision that you can request a no-cost six-month extension. And if we do that, we are talking about potentially running another cohort of the Blend Kit course next summer and actively soliciting more institutions to join us if you're interested. The only thing I would really ask is that if you do want to join and participate in the Blend Kit, then get under the tent with us and join group spaces. Send me an email. My contact, there is contact information on the Blended Learning Toolkit that will reach me eventually, so that we can start capturing your data. We'll put you on our listservs. We'll put you on our email lists. And that way we'll be able to understand who's using it and learn from you what's making sense. I did see John's hand go up. Did you want to say something first?
Outcomes, success, and surveys? Is there any way to look at their success in the next
I'll start on that one as well. I know Chuck and Patsy have things to say about this. We are, in fact, doing that at UCF. It's much easier to do that in a controlled environment where you have access to that kind of stuff. For the NGLC grant, and I don't mean this as a cop-out, but the truth is we are totally driven by the spreadsheet provided by SRI, which is sort of informed by the Gates agenda. And we need to fill in the spreadsheet for what it is. And the truth is, in the 15-month grant for $250,000, it's just really hard to get anything more than we're getting at the moment. Yeah. It would be nice, I totally agree, that we should be able to get to some of those deeper things, but I think it's going to take more money and time and resources to dig into those harder questions.
And I would argue, I think some of those harder questions are not served well by the whole grant structure, and it's not just in GLC. I mean, anyone who's had a grant understands there's always the issue of what you can do within the grant structure. I mean, we spent the first few months getting the training developed and actually administering the training, getting the folks to participate. So it's always a challenge, and obviously the higher the scale, the more complicated and much more difficult that is to determine. So with regard to the grant, the best that we can do is, you know, look at success within the specific course, and it's not perfect, but, you know, hopefully, I mean, it'd be nice to follow up with them to see those kinds of things, like how do they do after this. So, John, you had a question too?
Well, I kind of want to get to the auto category.
Yeah, yeah.
That's Chuck's question.
Mm-hmm. However, it strikes me that what we're trying to get at is tackling those issues and changing the course design. Now, there's a couple of things that can do that. Is it distributing the grant and sort of revenue incentives or stipend model? Mm-hmm. Is it the scholarship of teaching to see how the students actually perform? Is it blended learning toolkit that reduces the barriers to adoption? What do you think is that?
Stephen Johnson called it a liquid network. That is a network that is not too crystallized and one that is not too loose, an effective kind of. In the middle question there, what I think we need is the road to Damascus. You know, I think what we need is, in each of these campuses, faculty members to pass the burning bush and then to begin to convince other faculty that that's the only possibility I see with this. So in a sense, we have to be missionaries with respect to this. Now, the question that John asked, and by the way, I forgot to say something, and I'm going to say it now before I answer John's question. You know, we live in the world of Disney, okay? Let me tell you what Disney does every night. Every night, they run Boolean decision algorithms on what to sell, how many nights to sell each room they own. Every night. So they tell their salespeople, sell this night room for one night, two nights, three nights, or four nights. This has called revenue management, and they increase their profits immeasurably by doing this. And they have a series of adages which I think apply exactly to the question you asked, John. One is, there's good, fast, and cheap. Pick any two. Think about that. You know, you can do it fast, but you can't do it well. Okay? One, don't let technology drive the work. This grant is not about technology. Three, math and statistics are great, but they're not everything. Four, a great product makes a huge difference. Push power and flexibility out as far as you possibly can. Just because you can doesn't mean you should. Okay? Progress is much better made in bite-sized chunks. Simple is really better. And you ready? Senior executives have no idea what you're talking about. Make it relevant to their world. Now, what John has just asked me and the way I'm going to respond to him is, without knowing the culture of an individual campus, you won't know what the motivational technique to use on that individual campus. It may be money. It may be the scholarship of teaching and learning that gets faculty promoted. It may be some other thing. But John's question is right. You have to somehow pull the rods out and let the nuclear and hope that the reaction will start.
I will make one observation about that question. because I shared with you the amount of money that we're spreading around these 20 institutions, and it's very little. And while it's being used to incent faculty to redesign their courses, the truth is it's really not compensating them for the amount of work that they're doing,
right.
Professional development and redesigning their courses and all of that. And although I haven't interacted with all 2,600 faculty, the few that I do talk to, I've been really impressed across the institutions with their desire to just do a good job, to try to teach students effectively, to make an impact on this population that are most at risk. And I think that if the core of any message we have is that, to sort of appeal to the better nature of the faculty, I think for the most part, they respond. You know, that now we can't abuse them and ask them to do things without trying to compensate them or at least make it relevant for promotion and tenure or whatever else is important to them. But at the very core, they all want to do a good job, and they want to teach their students, and they want to impact lives. And I think that when we're looking at this grant, it's easy to get caught up in the spreadsheet, but I constantly have to remind myself that there's a reason why this was funded, and it really is to try and impact students, and faculty are out there on the front lines doing that.
I would argue also, Chuck mentioned the three groups, and I always think there, you know, this is true even in teaching classes. There's the group that will succeed no matter what you do, that you already, those are the early adopters that you already have the buy-in. They've figured out how best to design their courses to maximize the use of the blending. There are those who will, you'll never convince that this is worthwhile. And maybe we count those as lost causes. And the people in the middle are those that you're trying to reach and try to get them motivated. And I think it's a combination of all of that. I think removing obstacles for them is critical. If this is more work, our faculty, and I'm speaking now not from the grant, but from our own campus, you know, faculty are very busy, they're very stressed, and quite frankly, converting a course to blended is not probably something on their road to tenure. So tell me why this is going to be better for me and make it easy for me and decrease the obstacles, make sure the technology works, make sure you provide support for students so that when their technology doesn't work, I don't have to fix 20 different computers because I don't know how to do that. So I think it's a combination of all of those things. And we kind of got it, we're going to get snippets of that in some of the comments. I mean, I think some of the richest data we're going to get are the actual comments from the faculty and the students with this grant, because that's how we're going to get at some of those, what's really going on, what was their motivation, how did it really go, rather than just using Likert scale kinds of questions.
I go, Sue.
I'll take the first question because that's the only one I remember right now. So did we provide them with any analysis tools for it, and specifically related to the grant? No, because we didn't have to. We're doing all of the data analysis for the grant. So it was enough to ask them to develop the courses and just please, please, please provide us with the data. And I will be honest, every scrap of data I get involves at least 3 to 5 emails with the individual people. So, I mean, when I say as a control freak I had to let it go, I literally either had to just enjoy the process or go insane, one of the two. So we didn't need to do that. And we do that on our campus also. Our unit is, I mean, we are the go-to for faculty who need help. We get any range of people who are extremely savvy and already have their own statistical packages, but just kind of want to, you know, shoot the bull about their research design, to people who have no clue about how to design a survey and need help with that. What?
The second question was about more in-depth profiling of students. And we've done a little of that at UCF, although we want to be careful. We're certainly not doing it for the grant. We're really just looking at low income and age, and that's kind of it. Although we've asked questions about demographics and other things to try and capture some of that data, you could look at risk factors such as first generation college, socioeconomic background, ethnicity. I mean, all kinds of things can go into the sort of gumbo of profiling. And it might be, we were just having this conversation yesterday, mm-hmm. It might be a very legitimate profile, but it's a slippery slope where you don't want to start necessarily profiling students unfairly. Yet, could it also help you identify the students who are most at risk and intervene? Mm-hmm. We haven't quite threaded that needle yet ourselves.
Mm-hmm. I will tell you there are some grants under the NGLC funding that are specifically working with populations. The SUNY Network, Peter Shea and Alex Pickett, their grant is directly related to helping some of the at-risk low-income students in their area, and I'm sure they're gathering more data than would fit on a spreadsheet regarding that.
We'll make this the last question too, because we're out of time. The truth is the model that we're using in the grant is based upon the model that UCF has been using for 17 years. And the idea was to try and capture data in a consistent way that we could leverage to have a much larger data set that we could actually draw some inferences and some conclusions from, if possible. But having said that, we're always iterating to try and try and improve.
And that original bubble design I showed you began much more simplistically than what you saw. As we have evolved over through the years on our campus, our evaluation evolves as well. So, I mean, we now do lecture capture. We didn't do lecture capture 3. I mean, there are a lot of different components that continue to change the model of our evaluation.
Can I leave you with a metaphor? Okay, I'll leave you with it. Okay. Fella died, and he was right on the cusp. He had his choice whether to go to heaven or hell. St. Peter said you can go to heaven or hell. So he went and checked out hell. Fantastic. You know, women, golf, cars, it's spectacular. So he went to hell. And when he got to hell, it was the hell of James Joyce. It was awful. It was just awful. So one day he ran into the devil. And he said, "What happened? It was so wonderful, and now it's so awful." And the devil said, "Oh, that was the RFP you were looking at."
Thank you all. We'll hang out. Chuck has got another presentation to go to. Yeah.